morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Welcome to Office Hours. I am your host, Daniel Pink, broadcasting you from our state-of-the-art nerve center here in Washington, D.C., which regular listeners know is also my garage. And here in my garage, actually, on a Tuesday afternoon, and forgive all the folks listening in later on iTunes, but here in Washington, D.C., just moments ago, we experienced an earthquake, and it was absolutely freaky. And it was so freaky that I have, and I'll reveal this for the first time on this program, I have a series of bobbleheads, sports bobbleheads, and one of them fell to the ground. I don't know, which bobblehead was it? We're not sure. We think it was Ichiro. Ichiro Suzuki toppled to the ground in an earthquake. So anyway, so thanks especially to all of you on the East Coast who are calling in spite of this apparent natural disaster that took place very briefly. It looks like from my Twitter feed that nothing terrible has happened in this earthquake, which is good. It just freaked people out a little bit. So here's how Office Hours works. On each program, we open the phone lines for an hour, and then I, accompanied by a special guest, or in this case, two special guests, will take your questions about work, business, life, management, education, creativity, sports, romance, anything you want. If you have questions, we have answers, and when we don't, we will make something up. Now, today we've got something really special in store. Not one guest, but two. Teresa Amabile and Stephen Kramer, they're the authors of a new book, The Progress Principle. Now, I had the good fortune of reading this book a few weeks ago, and truly, and people know I don't say this lightly, it's one of the best business books that I've read in years. It's actually a really brilliant combination of scholarly depth and on-the-ground practicality. So let me briefly introduce them both, and then we'll explain how you can raise your hand virtually to ask questions of either Steve or Teresa. Teresa is the Edsel Bryant Ford Professor of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School, where she's also a director of research. The Progress Principle is, and among the books, which to my mind might be one of the very best scholarly works, if not the best scholarly work on innovation and creativity around. Stephen Kramer, his byline is Stephen, he goes by Steve. Steve Kramer is a PhD developmental psychologist whose work has appeared in the Harvard Business Review, the Academy of Management Journal, and Leadership Quarterly. He's also taught at Brandeis University. So, Teresa and Steve, thanks for being on the program.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah, it's our pleasure.
Now, where are you guys right now?
We are in the dining room of our home in Wayland, Massachusetts. It's a beautiful day here.
You're in Waltham, Massachusetts.
Wayland, Massachusetts. About 15 miles due west of Boston.
Got it. Okay. And did you, I mean, again, not to obsess over this for our live listeners, but you guys didn't feel that earthquake.
We did not feel it. And we've actually just been texting with our daughter who lives in central New Jersey, and she didn't feel it either.
Interesting. So it spared, well, who knows? Now, I should also point out, as astute listeners might have guessed, that Steve and Teresa are married. And so they did something that I think is quite extraordinary, a married couple together writing a book. Now, as someone who's written books, I know that it's an excruciating experience. Doing it with someone you care about, my hat is off to you, that both book and the marriage survived. But we'll talk more about that later. Now, for those folks, what we're going to do here is I'm going to talk to Teresa, ask Teresa and Steve some questions about the book, because I want to draw out some of these ideas, because I think they're, I mean, truly, truly important ideas. And then we'll go to the phone. Now, let's remind you how this all works here on Office Hours. So if you folks out there want to ask a question, just press *2, all right? If you want to ask a question, only press *2 if you want to ask a question, all right? Don't just press *2 willy-nilly way. As we had one caller once, our inaugural call with someone, he got on the line, and I said, "What's your question?" He said, "Huh? I thought you just said to press *2. So press *2 only if you want to ask a question. That will allow our crack team of producers to see you on the control panel here. I'll say your name, so Fred in St. Louis or Maria in Palo Alto. and we'll put you on the air, and then you can ask away. The other thing that was really cool that happened that's been happening lately is that organically people have been asking questions via Twitter. That's fine, too. Just include at Daniel Pink so we'll be able to see it. And do not include the hashtag earthquake. So before we go to the phones, let me ask you guys some questions here. So tell us what the progress principle is.
The progress principle is our discovery that of all the things that happen at work that can get someone really engaged in their work and feeling great, the single most important is simply making progress on work that they care about.
And that proves to be the kind of the single most motivating thing, the thing that keeps people going day to day.
Right. And this actually is a huge surprise to a lot of managers. In fact, after we finished our basic study, we gave a survey to almost 700 managers from a variety of companies around the world, and we gave them five employee motivators on the survey, and we asked them to rank these motivators in terms of how important they thought they were.
Okay, so tell us what were the five. So you're asking these managers, here are five things that motivate your employees, and rank them.
Right. So obviously we did have progress in the work, or supporting progress in the work was one that we included because we had discovered that that was actually the most important motivator. And we also included kind of the usual suspects of motivation. These are the kinds of things that you talk about in your book, Drive, Dan. So we had incentives, tangible incentives for the work. We had recognition. We had clear goals for the work. And we also included interpersonal support because we know that all of these things actually do motivate people at work. We wanted to see if these managers would recognize how important progress was. And interestingly, it didn't come in first or second or third or even fourth. Yes, it came in dead last in the survey. So if you think about it, even if these managers had been making their choices randomly, we would have expected 20% of them to pick progress number one, right? Instead, only 5% of these managers picked progress as the number one motivator.
Or,
so they were actively saying they didn't think it was that important.
So 5% picked progress. And so let me just pop up my Excel spreadsheet here. By my calculations, that 95% fundamentally misunderstood this.
Right, right.
I mean, that's kind of distressing. Now, let's talk about why. Both go right now. Why do you think that is? I want to get to how you made this surprising discovery because, I mean, I think that the methodology you use is really important and adds to the persuasiveness of what you found. But why did, you know, we're not, this is, you know, 95% missing the boat is a reasonably large number. Why? Why do they put rank progress so low on the list?
Well, that's not clear, but one reason is it has a lot to do with how they're trained in business schools, where they're taught a lot about incentive systems and things like that. And so I think that's what they've been trained to do and trained to focus on, rather than on paying attention to progress each and every day in the work, just the progress that's going on in the trenches in their organization.
Yeah, I think it's really tempting to say, well, you know, employees are supposed to make progress in their work. This is their job. So it's really easy for it not to be on a manager's radar screen. Also, management is really complex, and you know, managers and high-level leaders, managers at any level actually, have a lot to think about. And especially in times of economic turmoil like this, so I think it's just hard to keep it in mind.
Let me go to one more. Actually, Raj makes an interesting point here on Twitter, and I want to remind callers. We'll get to your live calls. Just hang tight with me, guys. Okay, we had a lot of people lined up already, and for those of you who want to ask a question, just press star two, and we'll see you on the control panel and the station. But Raj asked an interesting question on via Twitter. He's saying, is it possible that, that those managers misunderstood what progress meant? That is,
well,
is that a word, is that kind of in their managerial vocabulary even?
Well, I, when we ask people about this, they seem to understand what it is. The item that we, the way we worded it was supporting progress in the work. So what can you as managers do to motivate people, you know, give them tangible incentives, recognize work, you know, all
right.
these other things. And we had support progress in the work. So I think that that was pretty clear. I think that they probably did understand it. Could we tell you a little something about actually how we made this discovery about progress?
I was just going to get to that because I think that, you know, I just want people listening in to fasten their seatbelt here for a second because we are going to talk about research methodology, which in this case is absolutely fascinating. And as I mentioned earlier, adds to the persuasiveness of what they found out. So describe what you did because I think it's a real wow in terms of the depth and it gives a lot of credence to the findings.
So Steve and I are both psychologists, and we wanted to figure out a way to look deeply inside the hearts and minds of people at work to understand their everyday experience. And, you know, partly maybe because psychologists are kind of nosy, I don't know. We decided that the best way to do this would be to ask professionals at work to send us a confidential electronic daily diary. At the end of each workday, during the entire course of an important project they were doing. So some of these projects were as short as maybe 2.5 months. Some of them were as long as 9 months. And the volunteers who said, okay, I'll do this in the study, volunteered to fill out a questionnaire for us, a little daily diary survey, at the end of every workday, Monday through Friday, during the entire course of the project. So this was up to 9 months for some of these people. And we asked them on this diary form to just, you know, fill out a few little numerical scales about their emotions, perceptions, and motivations at work that day. We call that inner work life. We didn't call it that on the survey, but that's what we refer to as inner work life, emotions, perceptions, and motivations.
But you're
and
asking
then we
people,
asked,
and I think – I want to make this, put an underscore under this, is that you're asking people not to think about do you like your job, do you not like your job, are you satisfied, are you not satisfied. You're asking people, tell me about – is that right?
Dan, we can't hear you right now.
Oh, not good. Can you hear me now?
Yes, but you have actually been cutting out here and there for a few seconds at a time.
Okay, so let's just shout out if that happens again. So the question, I just wanted to underscore the which is that you're asking people, a lot of times in certain kinds of surveys and things, particularly that aren't done by academics, the question is, are you satisfied with your work? Do you enjoy your work? Do you like your work? That's it. But you're asking a different question. You're asking basically, tell me about how today was.
Exactly. We were taking the temperature of that day's psychological experience for the person.
Yeah.
So what was it like today? And the most important question was at the very end, we asked people to briefly describe one event that occurred at work that day that stood out in their minds. We said it can be anything at all as long as it's relevant to the work or the project. And that's where they actually wrote open-ended responses on this electronic diary. And that was the really rich treasure trove where we were able to look at the events that they were experiencing day by day, and we could tie that into their inner work life experience that day. We could understand how these events affected their daily psychological experience, and we also had separate performance measures. So we could tie all of these things together. How does inner work life influence performance? And how do events at work influence inner work life?
Right. And so in the end, give us a sense of the volume of – so you're getting individual answers from people every single day here. And give us a sense of the volume of material you ended up with.
Yeah.
How many diary reports?
We ended up with nearly 12,000 diary reports from 238 project workers.
Yeah, this is a mountain of data.
Yeah, it's a couple of mountains of data. I mean, you're talking 12,000 diary reports. So that's 12,000 days. So that's a several years worth of work there, right there.
Right.
But now, yeah, go ahead, yeah.
Yeah, because we combed through these 12,000 diaries to categorize every single event that people reported so that we could tie those events into their emotions and perceptions and motivations and tie that into how well they performed.
Right, and what you found is that the most significant motivator is making progress in meaningful work.
Exactly.
At the risk of acting like a lawyer here, let's unpack each word, all right? What does progress mean in those situations? That is, how did you give us a sense of what someone said, and you said, you know what, that is progress.
Okay, so if somebody said, as we had, a number of programmers that we studied, three high-tech companies, we had a number
right.
of teams in those companies. So it would happen from time to time that a software engineer would be struggling with trying to get something just right and would have a bug that was, giving them problems in the program. And if they said, I finally smashed that bug, that counted as progress.
Got it.
Or even if they said, I was able to eliminate some possibilities, so I know it's not these things, I'm getting closer, that counted as progress too. Interestingly, we found really strong positive effects on happiness and pride and intrinsic motivation, which is feeling passionate about your work, feeling
sure.
really engaged in your work. We found really powerful effects even if the progress looked almost trivial to us from the outside, if it seemed really incremental, what you'd call a small win, even those
yeah.
small wins could have a big impact.
Yeah. Let's pick up on that, because I think that's another really important finding. And guys, I mean, forgive me, we will get to the phones. We have people lined up. If you want to add your voice and ask a question, just hit star 2. You'll get in the queue. I see everybody who's in the queue right now. Just indulge me here. I feel like, Ronald Reagan in 1980, Mr. Breen, I paid for that microphone. So I paid for this microphone, so I get to use it for just a little bit longer. Let's pick up on what you said, Teresa. Things that seemed, I can't remember the precise word you used, trivial, superficial,
yeah.
unimportant.
Mundane.
Ended up being important. Now this is, there's a whole literature, as you guys write about in the book, and as you guys, I think, really build on profoundly, the literature of small wins. Now, my view as a journalist, as someone who writes about these things, is that we have overlooked and undervalued small wins out there, that we're always in the kind of hit a home run, big, hairy, audacious goal. And you're saying something different. So tell us about small wins and tell us why they matter so much.
I think one reason they matter so much is that they're so much more likely than huge breakthroughs in the work.
Right.
I mean, if you
right.
waited until you actually had, a spectacular success, you go through an incredibly long dry period. So, I mean, for
right.
us writing this book, and
sure.
you probably experienced this writing your own books, Dan, if we waited until the thing actually showed up in the mail as a real physical product before we felt good about anything, I mean, we would have quit long ago. So it's years, right? So and that's the case with a lot of the important work that people are doing nowadays in organizations. Take pharmaceuticals, for example. We've actually worked in some pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah.
Those people go years before something might end up in a commercialized drug that's going to help people get well. So you need small wins. You really need to feel that you have some kind of forward movement in the work, even if there are a lot of technical setbacks. And this is one of the most interesting things to us in this research. We had some teams that were doing extraordinarily difficult work technically, but as long as they were able to see some forward movement at the end of a day or even the end of a week when the team came together, if they could say, you know, these experimental trials didn't work, that didn't work. But if someone could raise their hand and say, yeah, but you know what? I've identified a compound that I think has some promising properties here, and they get in there and they talk about it, that made everyone feel great. Okay, we are getting somewhere.
Yeah.
There's a light somewhere at the end of this tunnel.
Interesting. Now, how do people see the progress that they're how do people see the progress that they're making? But how does somebody identify something as progress? I mean, is it something that you know it when you see it, or is it, does it require somewhat, as you were saying, a kind of collaborative effort where someone looks, you know, I show you a piece of code that I've just written, and you say, hey, I think you got it. I think you're this close to it. How do people glimpse that progress?
Well, initially they gauge it on their own. We judge their progress from their own diary entries. So if they, if they told us that they made progress, they might not even have perceived it as real progress. They didn't tell us, oh, I made a lot of progress today.
I see what you're saying, yeah.
They told us. I'm sorry.
Do you think it'd be helpful if managers sort of were more alert to that and said, hey, you know, sort of shined a light on that progress or helped people see the progress they're making?
Absolutely. And it's important for them to do so for a number of reasons. One is that people do want recognition for what they do.
Sure.
Another reason is that we haven't really talked about meaningfulness yet, but it's a cue to the meaning of the work they're doing. The manager saying to them he values something you've done for the organization.
Right. And so it's progress. And again, let's take that opening speed. It's progress on meaningful work. So how do we describe what's meaningful and what might not be meaningful at work? Is it possible to make progress on things that aren't meaningful?
Unfortunately, yes. And sometimes it's possible to make progress on things that actually are meaningful and not know it. But many people have the experience of having a day where they feel like, oh, they've put out fires, they've juggled a lot of things, they've got a lot of stuff done, but nothing done that they thought was important. And I think we've all experienced that at one time or another.
And you're describing three out of 7 days of my week.
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah. No, that's good. We need somebody. I know you guys are in organizational psychology and developmental psychology, but you probably know enough about counseling psychology to help me out a little bit here.
No, actually, we don't. our daughter used to tell her friends when she was younger and didn't know the term clinical or counseling. She used to tell her friends that my parents are psychologists, but not the kind that help people. Sorry, Dad. So we really actively try not to help people whenever possible.
We hope that you do find meaning in your work, Dad, because, I mean, it's just feeling that you're doing something that contributes to something that you value. And managers can play a really key role here by helping people see the connection between what they as individuals are doing day by day and some purpose that matters, either for the organization, for the team even, or, you know, ideally for customers getting a great product or great service, or for the community or the larger society.
Yeah, and so I want to get back. Let's take some questions here in a moment, but I think that there are things that managers can do, and I do think I've seen – it's interesting. I mean, you came up with this in a more analytical way. Just give you one quick anecdote here that I think verifies this. A long time ago, over a decade ago, I wrote a book called Free Agent Nation about the rise of people working for themselves. And to write that book, I went out around the country and interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, these long, in-depth interviews about, you know, why they left or what they felt like when they were pushed out of a large organization. I'm happy to say that this book remains in print even 10 years later. It now sells tens of copies every year. It's got my royalty statement. And But one of the things
I've
that was interesting.
Like that.
Yeah, one of the things that was interesting when you hear the language that people use is a lot of people kept saying, I felt, one reason I left, I felt I wasn't making a contribution. I wasn't making a contribution. That is, they were working, but they didn't see how what they did mattered at all. And, that, and you can understand how that's very alienating, that it sort of was devoid of some sense of progress, but it also was devoid of some sense of meaning. And I just think people just, we're not wired to live that way. We want something much more nourishing in the emotional sense. And I think that what you guys have done here really is put it in such a rigorous way that it becomes undeniable. Let's go to the phones here, guys. Are you ready to take some calls from the army of listeners out there in Radio Land?
Yeah.
We're going to go to
all
right, we're going to go to is it Micah or Mika? Misha in Chicago.
Yes, hello.
Hi, tell us your first name. Is it Michael, Misha?
Mike.
Mike. Okay, it's Mike. Mike in Chicago. Did you get an earthquake
yes.
in Chicago?
I did not get an earthquake in Chicago, no.
Okay, good.
We did not do it.
Chicago is such a tough city that if you had an earthquake, no one would be freaked out. They just, like, continue, you know, going to the Billy Goat Tavern and heading over to Wrigley Field and doing all. What's your question, Mike?
Right. I'm sure Ron would have to have someone sign off on it, too, first.
Mayor Emanuel would probably, like, go outside City Hall and start trying to punch the earthquake. He's such a mean guy. But let's forget about him in Chicago and tell us your question for Teresa and Steve.
My question is this. I deal with a lot of employees that are hourly or non-exempt, and
yeah.
it's hard for me to connect what they do on a daily basis to care, you know, to really get that purpose of what they're doing. Because at the end of the day, their results aren't necessarily affecting them monetarily or their workload at all. And maybe that's an issue for me to deal with later, but the bigger question is how to get them to have an intrinsic motivator rather than some sort of stick to give them or care to give them.
Yeah. Can you tell us, I mean, I don't want to, can you tell us what industry you're in and what your, those hourly?
Sure. So I am in the transportation industry, logistics, and I deal with accounts receivable personnel.
Okay. Teresa and Steve, the workers who you looked at were mostly, I think, were they exclusively white collar? I can't remember. But they were people doing fairly sophisticated work.
Yeah, they were almost exclusively work collar, but not entirely. Probably close to 10% were not what you would call, you know, high professional level. 85% of our participants had a bachelor's degree, and many had master's and PhDs. But we had a number of teams where there were some members of the team. People did participate as teams, although they sent in their diaries confidentially as individuals. There were some people on these teams who were secretaries, other kinds of administrative support for these teams, kind of keeping the books, or maybe people who are running the equipment in the lab, but who are really just doing sort of the technical assembly line kind of work. And we found that the progress principle actually applied for those people as well. And Mike, I think what's really interesting is for you to ask yourself maybe what is the role that these people have? You know, are they doing useless work? Presumably not, because you have them employed, right? They are working for the company. I think the creative exercise for you as a manager, and actually for them as individuals, is to think about what is it that we're contributing to what's getting done here. You know, this is a transportation organization. We're helping people to move from point A to point B and get there on time. You know, how is our work in accounts receivable playing a role in this whole system working well?
Okay, yeah, I think that makes total sense. Thanks for the feedback.
Yeah, and so I wonder also if there's a sense of I mean, I think it's a tough call in that, and you don't want to try to, you know, you want to be as I think, authentic and straightforward with people as possible. But is there any possibility that other people in the organization could somehow convey this message? That is, I don't know exactly what kind of transportation business you're in, but if they heard the value of their contribution from someone else in the organization, someone else who is more customer-facing, that would help. You see this sometimes in, say, hospitality industry, where you have the front of the house and the back of the house, or in a casino or in restaurants or things like that, where you have people who are customer-facing, and they end up having often reasonably satisfying jobs because they're getting quick feedback, they're getting great interaction. The people in the back of the house are invisible. And one of the things that has been done, I mean, actually in the gaming industry, is to have a little bit more kind of camaraderie, collaboration between the people in the back of the house and the people in the front of the house, so that the people in the front of the back of the house know that the people in the front of the house care about them.
Exactly. You know, my colleague Adam Grant, who's at Wharton, has done some fascinating research lately, looking at the power that it has to connect people at work, even in the what you're calling the back-end functions of an organization, connect them with the customers who are benefiting, or the clients, people who are using the service, or whatever it is. He's worked with people in call centers, and, you know, think of how mind-numbing that is.
Yeah.
And how difficult it must be for people in call centers to feel engaged. But if they can just have some contact with people who benefit positively from the work that they do, that can have an enormous impact on them.
Yeah, so I hope that's helpful, Mike. Thanks a lot for calling in. Let's go to Dennis in Andover, Massachusetts. We got a lot of other callers here. Let's go to Dennis in Andover. Dennis, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Dennis, Hello. What's your question? Welcome to Office Hours.
Well, I tweeted about it too. Book by Alfie Cohn in 1996 called Beyond Discipline, From Compliance to Community.
Yeah.
And your book, Dan, Drive, both point out the same thing that these authors have come up with, which is that you have to have mastery in order to feel significantly motivated. What I'm wondering is why since 1996 in education and why more recently in business and other organizations is it taking so long for people to realize that this is an important concept and that they're significantly undervaluing the students they're working with and the employees that they're working with, and when are they going to change?
Teresa, I'm going to hold you possibly responsible for this, training those armies of Harvard Business School students.
I want you to know, so Steve and I are sitting here at the dining room table pointing the finger at your question. No, this is your question. Steve actually was a teacher, a preschool and elementary school teacher for a number of years. I was a middle school teacher for 1 year. This was both before we went to get our doctorates.
Yeah.
And this is a very, very tough question because it has larger political ramifications, obviously. But I'm going to let Steve take this one.
I think the reason is that even though this is something that sounds simple, but is really the reality is it's hard to do because it's about doing the work. It gets right down to the essence of doing the work. You're helping people to really make progress every single day. You need to provide them with the resources they need when they need it. You need to provide them with the help they need when they need it. And it's much easier to worry about manipulating incentives and carrots and sticks and try to get people to behave that way. This is, in essence, the hard work of doing work.
That's right, and I think that's true whether we're talking about school children learning. You know, it's much easier to say, okay, we've got this test here, and everybody has to learn the items on this test. They have to be able to, you know, recite their multiplication tables or do this, you know, do this kind of equation, rather than to say, you know, we're going to figure out how kids really learn and help them to learn how to be good learners. That's really much more difficult than trying to get people to memorize something. But it has much greater benefits in the long run.
And Dennis, are you an educator?
I'm a recently retired superintendent of schools in Massachusetts.
Okay, so I mean, so why don't you? I mean, why don't, let me turn the question on you. What do you think the reason is? I mean,
well,
you have.
I think it's a lot more simple and a lot more complicated than we like to believe. Simple in the sense that, as the subtitle for Alfie Cohn's book points out, we've got to go from compliance to community. In an environment where students are being and teachers are being asked to follow rules, you can't have community. Where the circumstances are such that they're asked to follow the lead instead of becoming autonomous, you can't reach a point where you start to feel comfortable mastering concepts and ideas and learning well. Where control in the classroom is such that the students are constantly taught from the first grade to the 12th grade that they're supposed to follow directions and do what they're told. You can't create an environment that's going to allow them to feel mastery, and so therefore motivation is undercut the entire way. On the other hand, if you do get those things, if you take, you'll allow students to start to take autonomous responsibility for their things. If you do loosen up that control and you start focusing more on mastery, you can really create a community of learners that really can be very powerful. And I would assume the same kind of thing would happen in other in organizations that you're more familiar with than I probably am.
That's true, Dennis. The thing is, it's risky. I mean, I think that it's frightening for managers, especially new managers, to give up what they perceive as giving up power, to allow people to have autonomy. On the other hand, it's really the smart thing to do, because no one knows better than the person doing that work, facing that job, what the details of that job are, so. You know, getting people to engage their own creativity and their own talents and expertise is the best way to go in the long run. In the short run, it's easier and less frightening to take control.
Absolutely.
and to try to manage everything people are doing.
I once made the comment to a person that what happens in a democracy, and I was thinking of school boards, what happens in a democracy when they ignore the research? It just seems to me that your work is pointing out what the research shows is true, and what we really do know is true when we really look at the reality of things, that you have to have mastery, that you have to have control, you have to loosen control, and you have to allow people to have autonomy if you're going to move forward in a positive way. And until we reach the point where we admit that that's the truth, and that the question becomes, how are we going to go about doing this, as opposed to ignoring the truth and not even trying? I don't think we're going to have much luck.
Thanks, Dennis, for the great call. I think Dennis makes some profound points. I think there is a lack of willingness to recognize that truth, and I think it goes to what Teresa and Steve were both saying, is that I think there's a sense of short-termism, because a lot of these other kinds of more mechanistic controlling things, they do work in the short term. I mean, if you offer me here on this program that it's free of charge and free of advertising, if you were to suddenly say to me, hey, if you get 100,000 listeners this month, Dan, I'm going to give you a huge bonus, you know, I probably will respond to that incentive. I'm not going to book Amabile and Kramer. I'm going to book, you know, Justin Bieber and Britney Spears. I'll respond to that, but it so these things work in the short term, and I think that we neglect sometimes to realize how easy some of these other measures are, and how difficult, just to go to your language here, to the Kramer and Amabile language, is, you know, how do managers catalyze progress? You guys talk about they set clear goals, they allow autonomy, they provide sufficient resources. That's much more complicated, much more difficult, much more complex than simply dangling a carrot out in front of somebody. Let's go to, I don't have a first name here. I only have a first initial, but the initials are BN, B as in boy, N as in Nancy, and you're in New York City. So BN, you're on the line.
Hi, it's Barbara.
Hey, Barbara.
Hey, how are you doing, Dan?
I say that like I've known you since I was in kindergarten, but welcome to the program.
Thank you. I guess you've sensed me reading your books as I read them. I'm a clinical psychologist, so I.
Oh, good. We're so glad to have you here.
Oh my gosh, you're the kind who helps people.
I've had an existential crisis, and we have a slight marital dispute over question answering here. So welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad people on this call think we actually help people. By the way, I felt the earthquake in New York, and people have been emailing all over the place about the earthquake. So we all felt it here.
Wow. Are you you're in New York? Are you in Manhattan, or are you in one of the other boroughs?
I'm in Manhattan.
All right. So it's felt in Manhattan. Wow. All right.
Yeah.
Welcome to the program. What can we do for you?
Well, you know, I don't really have a particular question. It's just what's interesting to me about this is that I've been reading all of this literature, and I'm constantly thinking how it applies to clinical work and how it moves back and forth between the business world and the clinical world of people who come into my office. And these are exactly the kinds of things that I'm working on with people. What's fascinating to me is that, you know, if you think about what motivates people, even the idea of progress in clinical work. Now, I do short-term as well as long-term work, but feeling that progress is so important to people. And what I find interesting is taking this work and actually applying it to clinical work. It's kind of like the old wine in a new bottle, but what's fascinating to me is in terms of clinical psychology and psychotherapy, the field has been doing this kind of work, thinking this way for some of us at least, for years, but it's looked at as this kind of weird thing, even in New York City, you know, like, but there's so much of this that applies to helping people change, whether it's in the business world or
how do you, in your work, help people see their progress? And
how do I do it?
And what sort of lesson or takeaway would a manager have from what you do?
Oh, interesting question. I will explicitly say in almost every session, but not necessarily intentionally. It's almost like what you're saying. It's not like the short term, you know, the little carrot you give to the horse each time. You know, it's much more woven in. But I will say, okay, this thought or this, you know, what you did between last week and this week is a direct step forward and result of some of the meaningful work we've been doing.
Uh-huh.
And so I will show it in the work. And then, of course, people are coming in and talking to me about work. And so I will bring that out and talk to people, and managers will go back and think about their work in terms of what goes on, you know, the interchange between what goes on personally, individually, and then how they are organizationally working.
Barbara, this is really exciting to me to hear that you actually do this in your psychotherapy practice, because this is exactly the kind of thing that we're encouraging managers to do for people who work for them, and actually for workers to do for themselves as well. We have this interesting, unexpected side effect from the research that we did. When we were about to end our study of a particular team, and we went in and did a workshop for them, we would tell them, you know, okay, the diaries have stopped now, and let's, you know, talk about what we saw going on in this team and how we can help you work better on your next project. Some of these people asked us if we could continue to send them the diary form, even though they were no longer in the study.
Interesting.
They said, you know, we found this so useful to have this little bit, 5 minutes of reflection at the end of the day, which we don't take normally. And they would say things like, I don't think I'll have the daily discipline to do it myself, so could you please keep sending the diary form? So we actually recommend that people use a form of journaling to keep track of their progress. And I think that this might, I don't know if you use cognitive behavioral therapy, Barbara, but it seems to me that that's part of what you want to do, is help people to, for themselves, rather than feeling discouraged at the things that they aren't doing well, feel great about what they are doing, what progress they are making.
Right, and you can do that through journaling, but if you think about it in a more abstract level, each psychotherapy hour is a moment you create a space for people to reflect on what they have done, what's gotten in their way of making progress, and the progress they've made as the incentive for the changes.
Wonderful.
Thank you, Barbara, for the great call. Let's go, we only have about 10 minutes left here, so let's be somewhat prescriptive here and talk about what else individuals can do. Journaling was one of your ideas, and you analogize it sounds a little woo-woo to say, oh, let's have everybody keep a journal, all right? It sounds a little woo-woo, but what you guys say in the book is you make the analogy to physical stress, and you now have companies that offer yoga, companies that offer fitness centers. And so maybe this is something that's analogous to their inner work lives. That is, maybe something companies should be encouraging.
Right. 5 minutes
of journaling.
Yeah, right. We think that it has to be really confidential, though, if it's going to be useful to people.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They can't feel that it's something that the company is going to be looking at.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we think that reflecting on, maybe there were difficulties today, and it can be really useful to write about the difficulties, to think about the setbacks and to plan how to deal with them the next day. That's very useful, and there's some good psychological research showing that. But also to allow yourself, as Barbara used the term, a little bit of space, a little bit of psychological space at the end of the day, to think about even one thing on which you did make some progress, and ideally it will be something that does matter to you, and then to think about how you can create some time for yourself the next day to get something done on work that is important to you. We also recommend
you guys have your form somewhere on your website. Is that right? That kind of questionnaire.
Well, we have actually two kinds of things on the website. One is a daily journaling form, which we recommend that people use for themselves. That can easily be adapted, though, for use by managers. And what we have in the book is a daily progress checklist for managers.
That's a little bit different. The website is progressprinciples.com. That's the name of the book, too. The book is The Progress Principle. But the website is progressprinciples.com. And I think that form could be really useful, especially if people can, have the chance to retrofit it to their own needs. Is it under diaries there? It's progressprinciple.com, and then there's a subset called work diaries. If you go there, listeners, you can find it.
I think that
these kinds of things, what I like about them is that they're very actionable. It's not something that's going to take you huge amounts of time. It's not, let's have another meeting at the end of the day. It's something that people can do that's quick and it's actionable. I have another recommendation for listeners, something that I just discovered and I've been using for 3 weeks. It's sort of it's a blunter instrument than the ones that you have, but it's a site called idonethis.com. idonethis.com. So, and what they do, it's very much, it's probably somewhere in the family tree that these folks are related to you. What they do is every day, you register, it's free, and they send you an email at the end of the day. Sound familiar? And then you respond to that email by saying what you got done today. And then it calculates that, or not calculates, it logs that. And then they have a calendar that shows check marks, every day you got something done. And you can go back and say, what did I get done on Tuesday? And so it seems like those kinds of simple mechanisms can be really useful to people. Give us another tip of what an individual might do, him or herself, to make progress, to see progress, to seek catalysts for their work, to seek nourishers for their work.
I think one thing that can be very useful, since most people work in teams now inside organizations, is to actually give some of these catalysts, these progress catalysts, to your teammates. And there's a really wonderful reciprocal effect that we saw going on in some of the better teams that we studied. So looking at who on the team needs help, who might need some mentoring, who seems to be having difficulty with a technical problem, or even just finding some information, who's new on the team maybe, and providing some help there can lead people to then feel by reciprocity that they want to help you when you're struggling with something. And that can have really positive effects inside a team. In addition to these progress catalysts, we also talk about nourishers, which can directly lift people's inner work life, can just make people feel better at life.
Give us an example of a nourisher. Give us an example of a nourisher and its effective deployment inside of an organization.
So a great one is emotional support. If people are having some difficulty, say, in their personal life, and they let it be known to the people they work with, to their immediate supervisor, it's incredibly validating to have people simply acknowledge that. So one of the teams that we were studying, someone's brother was in a really bad accident and was in the hospital, and these people in their diaries, this team was so great at providing these inner work life nourishers to each other that in their diaries they said, oh my gosh, this team member had this terrible thing happen in her family. We're really rooting for her and her brother. They actually stopped by the hospital after work to see if they could bring anything. Did this person need anything? And when she stopped back at work, she came back to work a few days later for half a day because, you know, her brother seemed to be maybe out of the woods. They just lavished a lot of attention on her. And in their diaries that day, those people who were lavishing the attention felt better. Their intrinsic motivation for what they were doing was higher, and they felt happier and a greater sense of pride. And there's this wonderful emotional contagion that can go on. So, you know, it's really like, you know, pay it forward, get it back.
Yeah.
Of course, there's a big downside to the progress principle, Dan, which we really haven't gotten into, but everything we've said in the positive can happen in the negative in a big way, and the negative can have a more powerful effect. So we've talked
about
how great progress
is. I wanted to get to two quick substantive things and then one personal thing in our final 4 minutes here. So the substantive thing was the fact that you say that negative events can have a more powerful effect than positive events. Give us an example of a negative event and why that might put you, I guess what's the opposite of progress, decay, decline, reversal, you know, trigger the reversal principle.
Sure. The most obvious negative analogy to progress are setbacks, and setbacks have a profound negative effect on inner work life. People feel less motivated after they've had a setback. They're less happy. They're more extrinsically motivated, less intrinsically motivated. And so setbacks is the most common example we saw. But this applies really to any kind of negative event. And what we found was that the effect of setbacks on inner work life, the negative effect of setbacks on inner work life, was 2 to 3 times stronger than the positive effect of progress on inner work life. So it's critical for managers to really make sure that they do everything they can to remove obstacles and hassles that get in the way of making progress, because those can just have a terrible negative effect.
And you guys do write a little bit about how this, about kind of a positive affect, or what you call the positive inner work life, leads to greater progress and greater productivity, which goes against this more kind of traditional notion that, hey, we want people to be scared, we want people to be alert, we want them to know that their job is on the line, and that will foster, you know, performance.
Right. This is maybe we should have said this a lot earlier, but people perform better when they have positive inner work lives. They're more creative on those days. On those days, and actually the next day as well, they're more creative, more productive. They're more committed to their work, and they're better colleagues to each other when they have better inner work lives.
There you go. I mean, what more do we need? One quick question about because this is a question that. That I've gotten a lot on the blog and in email and so forth is time pressure. And you guys have, I think, a really nuanced, intriguing view of what role do say deadlines and time pressure play in people having that inner work life and making progress.
Yeah, time pressure can have really very negative effects on inner work life and creativity, except when it doesn't. So the most common kind of time pressure in organizations is where people feel like they're running on a treadmill all the time, juggling a lot of balls in the air that are being thrown at them from every direction, doing a lot of fragmented, unrelated tasks. that aren't directly getting them anywhere on their most important work. So the best kind of time pressure for creativity is sort of low to moderate, except when people feel that they are really working on an urgent mission, something they desperately care about, they understand why it's important, it's hugely meaningful, and where they're protected from these unrelated, fragmenting demands, and they can really focus on the crucial problem.
You have a nice way of putting the two, sort of the negative time pressure and the positive time pressure. Tell us about that. Then we'll ask you one personal question.
Yeah, the negative time pressure is being on a treadmill, and this positive time pressure we call being on a mission.
Right, and so that's the answer to it. It's positive when you're on a mission. It's negative when you're on a treadmill. I think that's a lovely way to put it. I actually wish I in the book I remember writing, wish I had thought of that one.
there is one caveat we will make to being on a mission, and that's that you can't keep people on a mission all the time. They will simply burn out. It can't be sort of a punctuated event.
Yeah.
Right. It's kind of sort of a short sprint on something meaningful. Okay, so one last question here as we wrap up. So what's it like writing a book with your spouse? Who wants to answer that one?
you said that earlier you said writing a book could be excruciating. It can be doubly excruciating with your spouse. Actually, it was wonderful to share the discoveries that we were making over the years that we were analyzing these data and writing the book. It was fun to talk about this stuff on our walks and over meals. It could get a bit much at times. Do you want to say something?
Sure. I mean, Teresa and I have very different styles. So
that's what I wanted to get at.
It is a bit of a challenge. She's very, very detail-oriented, and I'm not so detail-oriented, I admit it. But, you know, I'm more of a big-picture kind of person, to put the positive spin on that.
So he is. He's a big-picture thinker. He throws out lots of ideas all the time, and some of them stick and some of them don't. And I'm much more methodical and organized and delve into the data and really try to see those discoveries emerging. I think our styles are complementary, although I have to say there was considerable gnashing of teeth at certain moments here.
Now, how do you resolve a dispute over, say, a particular word to use in a sentence?
Teresa wins.
I win.
No, I don't think we very often had major arguments over syntax. We had arguments over more important things, but not
okay,
over
syntax.
Okay,
give me an example of an argument over an important thing you might have had.
I think that what issue was, all right, do we believe that we're seeing evidence of catalysts directly in making people feel good? So if you get a resource, is that something that directly impacts inner work life, or does it just help inner work life because it helps you make progress? And it took us a long time,
to thresh that through. Yeah, that's an interesting thing.
Ultimately, we went to the data. But I have to say, when we had great moments, and there were many, we would do belly bumps right here in our living room. We've got a nice long living room. And we would take a running leap. Well, I would take a running leap at Steve because he's about twice the size of me. And we would do a belly bump. And we would do that for you now, Dan, but I think on radio it just doesn't work quite as well as video.
No. I'll leave that to the listener's imagination as a final image for a wonderful hour with two smart, engaging, and I think people who have written a book that I think is really important. And again, listeners know I don't throw out those grandiose terms very lightly. So Teresa and Steve, thanks for being with us. The book is The Progress Principle, Using Small Wins to Ignite Joy, Engagement, and Creativity at Work. It is an outstanding business book, one of the best I've met in many, many years. It is, as I mentioned at the top of the program, almost the perfect combination between really rigorous research but really actionable ideas. So I think it belongs on all of your Kindles, iPads, and if you're still reading on paper, your bookshelf. You can find it at any bookstore or your favorite online bookseller. It's The Progress Principle by Teresa Amabile and Stephen Kramer. Check out their website at progressprinciple.com. That is it for this episode of Office Hours. this program will be available for free in a few days at danpink.com. As I mentioned, you can learn more about Teresa and Steve at progressprinciple.com. Next month on Office Hours, we'll be talking to Marcus Buckingham, one of the leading catalysts of the strength movement, co-author of a couple of blockbuster books. He has a new book coming out that takes the idea of using your strength to a new dimension. That's going to be on September 16th at 11 a.m. Eastern. Until then, for Tim Grawl in Lynchburg, Virginia, who also survived the earthquake, Director Jessica Lerner here at World Headquarters in Washington, D.C., where the only casualty was my Ichiro bobblehead, I'm Daniel Pink. You've been listening to Office Hours. If you've missed an episode, please check us out on iTunes.